This is the last session in the leadership, the leader section. This is session 5. Again, I'm assuming that you've gone through the 10 sessions, 11 sessions that I did as part of the intro course for CLI. You'll notice that this one is titled Dealing with Despair. But just a reminder of where we're coming here. We've been talking about this model of leadership, the leader with culture and vision and prayer and planning. Here's the words that I've been putting on this, the definition, my definition of leadership. A leader with all of his pluses and minuses, strengths and weaknesses, interacts with a group of people to define the culture, the way things are done here, in order to develop a vision for a preferable future, and then provide the impetus for doing the actions necessary to bring about that future with plans and prayer. So that's what we're talking about. Now, just a note here. Next week we're going to move on to culture. And this class is kind of a combination of, as I said in session 1, of those first 11 that occurred back in the intro class. And so, you know, if you hear references back that you're not aware of, just keep on plowing through the class at this point. But next time we're going to move on to culture. But today I want to deal with one more aspect of you being the leader and the leader in this process that we call leadership. And that is dealing with despair or those times when you're driving on empty. You know, there's an old Seinfeld TV program here in the United States back in the 1990s. It still is on reruns everywhere. But there's a one episode where one of the main characters, Kramer, gets in a car for a test drive at a car dealership. And of course, they don't put much gas in it when they sell the car. But he's in there with the salesman, and they try to see how far they can go before they run out of gas. I mean, it's on empty. How far can they go? They're out there. Can they get back to the dealership? And so it becomes this kind of celebratory thing when they roll into, on fumes, roll into a gas station, that they made it all the way just a block from the dealership. Well, sometimes Christian leaders act that way too. They end up pushing themselves until they're running on empty, and they become despairing of ministry entirely. I talked to a young man just a short while ago, and I run into him at the school where my grandchildren go, and I know he's a pastor in a church in my area. And so I ask him every once in a while, how are things going? And on this particular day, he just had it. And then we began looking at his life and his ministry in a church that has a lot of older people, and they were sick. And in a very short period of time, I think it was like 3 or 4 months, he'd had 22 funerals. I can't imagine that. All that goes into a funeral, first of all, caring for people while they're dying and their family for while they're dying. And then in the dying process, and then planning the funeral with the family, and then the emotional aftermath of that. After funerals, I'd always be wiped out. And I'm thinking, 22, that's an average of 2 a week. How could you do that? And then be expected to get up there on Sunday again, as well as be expected to lead anything, as well as expected he was to teach a class in the church, and et cetera, et cetera. And then he had problems with one of the employees in that church. I had quit abruptly, and that was not necessarily a sad loss for him, but now I was saying things about him that weren't really true. And so I said, whoa, how are you doing? And his response was, I'm ready to quit. Most leaders I know go through those kind of experiences at some time or another. One man compared it to, you know, you're going to the desert and you're on your last legs. You can't even walk anymore. So you're crawling through the sand just hoping for a glass of water. Now, I've mentioned Gordon MacDonald before. In his book on restoring your spiritual passion, he describes what this is like in the heart and soul of the leader. He says, it is action without heart, oratory without power, doctrine without love. Inside they, or people who are burning out like this, they experience a rising turbulence, confused goals and motives, and inconsistent, unexplainable patterns of personal performance. Yeah, I've been there. I remember going out at night, walking my dog, and there was a small hill where I lived in the first congregation I served. And I would stand on that hill at night, look up at the stars and say, how long, God? How long do I have to do this? And it's surprising to me that some great leaders, if they're honest, will express that they do the same thing. This is a picture of W.E. Sangster. He was a very, very well-known pastor and preacher, best known in London for many, many years. In fact, he had an evening service on Sunday that would pack out the place that he preached with 2,500 people, and was influential in the city. He was engaged in a lot of things, and yet he went through a people like this. This is what he describes as his world. Dried out, is how he put it. He said, I am a minister of God, and yet my private life is a failure in these ways. A, I am irritable and put out. B, I am impatient with my wife and children. C, I am deceitful in that I often express private annoyance when a caller is announced and simulate pleasure when I actually greet them. D, from an examination of my heart, I conclude that most of my study has been crudely ambitious, that I wanted degrees more than knowledge and praise rather than the equipment for service. E, even in my preaching, I fear that I am more wondering what people will think of me than what they think about my Lord and His Word. F, I have long felt in a vague way that something was hindering the effectiveness of my ministry, and I must conclude that that something is my failure in living the truly Christian life. G, I am driven in pain to conclude that the girl who has lived as a maid in my house for more than 3 years has not felt drawn to the Christian life because of me. And H, I find slight envies in my heart at the greater success of other young ministers. I seem to match myself with them in thought, and I am vaguely jealous when they attract more notice than I do. Wow. Now that's somebody who was a success. You know? Everything's going right as far as outwardly. People would look at his ministry and say, wow, W.E. Sangster. That's how people looked at him in history. This is a giant, and yet he's reflecting those kind of things. All I'm trying to say is it's going to be normal for you to go through times of tiredness, times of wearing out, times when you say, I want to quit. I don't want to do this anymore. I can't do this anymore. So what I want to talk to you is how do you handle that in your life? One of the great examples from Scripture is, of course, Elijah. Hopefully you know the story of Elijah well. Elijah is a prophet of God. God tells him to go to Ahab, the evil king of Israel, and to tell him, it's not going to rain again unless I say so, basically Ahab says, and he's speaking on part of God, and so he's saying, unless God makes a declaration, it's not going to rain again. And that introduced a period of 3 years of drought in the country. And because Ahab wanted to punish Elijah for the message, he looked for him all over the country, couldn't find him. Well, God had told him to go and hide by a brook named Cherith or Cherith, depending on what translation you look at. And there the question is, you're out in the wilderness, there's this little stream that you can get water, but how are you going to get food? And miraculously, God sent ravens with food to feed him. I mean, imagine that. Ravens aren't known, they're scavenger birds, and so they're not known for giving up their food, they're known for fighting over food, and yet here they feed him for a period of time. And when the drought has gotten so severe that the brook dries up, he's sent to Zarephath, and he finds a widow there who doesn't have the capacity, he's almost out of resources, and there he becomes a house guest to them, and God miraculously supplies what they need. So he's a prophet of God. He's seen God supply for him in magnificent ways, miraculous ways. And it culminates when God says, okay, it's time to go back and confront the people of Israel and confront the king. And so he shows up again, and he challenges the king to kind of a duel between God and the other gods that are being followed in Israel at that time. And it's all going to take place on Mount Carmel. And he gets the people together there, and there's 400 prophets of 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of Asherah, these two idols. Baal is considered to be the fertility god, and he's pictured with a lightning rod. So if you wanted good crops, you prayed to and you sacrificed to Baal. Or if you wanted children, you sacrificed to Baal. And Asherah was a sexually oriented thing. Anyway, All these prophets, 950 prophets on one side and Elijah on the other. And he gives the challenge. He said, let's build an altar, said, and put a sacrifice on it. And the God that answers by fire is the real God. And he turns to the people, and what do you think of that? And they say, oh, okay, it sounds good. Or they're silent. They are just so calloused against God at this point, or ignoring him, that they can't even answer positively. But the challenge is taken. All morning, the other prophets are dancing around that altar. They are calling upon Baal and Asherah to respond with fire. And when he doesn't, you know, Elijah kind of goads them and says, well, maybe he's on a vacation somewhere. Oh, maybe he's traveling. Maybe he's asleep and you got to wake him up. And so they start cutting themselves, hoping that that self-mutilation will get the God's attention. And after a period of time, it's obviously that God is not going to answer. And then God moves Elijah to rebuild the altar to Jehovah God that's there. And he rebuilds it, and he puts the sacrifice on the altar. And he directs people to take water, this precious resource that is so rare, and dump it over the altar over and over again. And then he humbly prays to God. He said, okay, God, now's the time. Show that you are who you are. And boom, fire comes down and consumes it all. What an incredible moment. The people began crying, the Lord, he is God, the Lord, he is God. And they're ready for a revival to happen in the country. And Elijah says, all right, kill all of those prophets. And so they take them into the valley, and Elijah killed them all, 950 of them. And then he comes to Ahab the king, and he says, okay, now I'm going to pray for rain. He goes up on the hill, and he prays, and he sends his servant to look, is there any clouds coming? And eventually, after a couple of times of that, he says, I see a cloud the size of a man's hand. And Elijah goes down to Ahab and says, heads toward Jerusalem, there's rain coming. And it said that Elijah, with all this energy, imagine the adrenaline flowing of this great victory, adrenaline flowing in his veins, where it said he runs in front of the chariot all the way back to Jerusalem. And the rain comes. And he expects this great revival to happen in Israel. But instead, word comes to Jezebel, the queen, and says, she sends a messenger to Elijah and says, by tomorrow you're going to be dead, is basically what he says. And it's a fascinating thing to me that Elijah had seen God work in so many powerful and miraculous ways, and yet what does Elijah do when he's threatened like that? Well, we read Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. He came to a broom bush out in the wilderness, sat down under it and prayed that he might die. I've had enough, Lord, he said. Take my life. I'm no better than my ancestors. Wow. How could that be? Now just picture him. He's somebody who's a lot like W.E. Sangster. A lot like you've probably felt if you've been involved in ministry at any time or another. Just let me be done with it. I'm no better than my ancestors who have been rejected by the people of Israel. Just let me die. Let me out of this. Let me do something else, you know. I want to just push a cash register. I just want to drive a truck. I don't want to do this anymore. And it's a powerful moment for Elijah. How would God respond? It's the way God responds to you and to me when you're in such a time, if we make the right choices. The first thing he does is God responds by letting him rest. He falls asleep. And we don't know how long that sleep is, but the way it's phrased in the scriptures, it's like he went into this deep sleep. He's exhausted. He's had this huge expenditure of energy, and now he's just wiped out. And so he lets him rest. Then there's this miraculous feeding that happens. An angel shows up. This is a painting by a famous painter. Of this event, an angel shows up and gives him food. He's going to need energy. And so feeds him. And this process goes over, rest and feeding for a while. And then he is further given an experience with God himself. He is told to go to Mount Sinai, which is down in the wilderness. It's quite a trip. He goes there, and there God meets him. Here's a picture of Mount Sinai. I had the privilege of being at Mount Sinai a few years back. And one of the things they point out, at the base of the mountain, there's a monastery called St. Catherine's. But up on the mountain, they've created this chapel, which is called Elijah's Chapel, because this is supposedly the place where Elijah met God. Another group says, no, this is the cave. This is Mount Sinai. This is the cave where Elijah asks God to reveal himself. He's whining about, you know, I'm the only one left. I'm the only one left. And God says, okay, hang on. And he comes and there's this great storm, and God's not in the storm. God, remember, is in the still, small voice. And then God, after the rest, after the feeding, after the experience of knowing God is real, he's alive, God gives him a new mission. He says, I want you to anoint this person king here, I want you to anoint this person king here, and I want you to get a mentor partner, Elisha. And so Elijah begins to mentor Elisha into the role that he's going to play now in the kingdom of God. Now, I point all this out to you just to say that this is how God wants to deal with you as well when you get tired. You need rest. Now, you should be getting that on a regular basis as a leader if you're going to be good. But there are times, there are seasons when you're going to want rest. You're going to crave rest. And there's just not time for it. When you go to sleep, you can't figure out how you're going to stay asleep because you wake up in the middle of the night. And the network of leaders that I had that we'd meet in Southern California, they came from all over the country. We'd meet for 4 days together just to talk about mutual things. We all were leading churches of about the same size, same tradition, and we'd learn from each other. And whoever was leading, there would be two people who were designated as the leaders to set the agenda. One year, one person put on the agenda, what do you take to sleep? Because sometimes it's hard to sleep. So we talked about medications for making sleep more likely. The reality is that people who are leaders have minds, and particularly entrepreneurial leaders, have minds that keep going and going and going, and they're running and running and running. And so how do you slow down your mind enough to sleep? Well, usually you have to withdraw from ministry for a time. You know, I'm pretty hard on, I've earned that right, I think, after long years of ministry. I'm pretty hard on the person who says to me, young ministers in particular, one man who I was mentoring said, well, you know, I haven't had a vacation. I haven't had a vacation in 4 years. You say, why not? Well, I just can't leave. I got news for you. You are not Jesus Christ, the head of the church. He can do just fine without you there for a while. You're going to need rest. And that may mean withdrawing from ministry. A good friend of mine, whom I know, and you're going to hear an interview with him later in this course, he began a practice approved by his church that 1 week per year was not his vacation time, it was his rest time. And he would go away, and he would spend time, and he was a pastor here in Michigan, so he would choose December when winter is setting in, and it's dark and gray and cold here, and he would go down to a place in Florida, and he would just walk the beaches, and he'd go see a movie if he felt like it, he'd read what he felt like reading, and he'd spend a week just to be recharged and renewed. Now, I never had that privilege, but I made sure that I took all of my vacation time. In addition to that, I made sure that I had some study time. In other words, it wasn't study time around the pressure of, oh boy, I got to get a sermon out Sunday. But it was time to withdraw from ministry and to just recoup, to be fed again. My feeding, you know, in the United States is not physical. Maybe for you it is, that you need to spend a time eating well for a period of time. But for me, it was always feeding myself spiritually. And so there are certain people that I would listen to their sermons, or I would read their books, people whose Bible studies I had a real respect for. And so I would read those Bible studies, or I'd watch them on video on my computer. And these are people who would refresh me. They would feed me. And then there were those times when I would seek experiences with God. And so I would just ask people to tell we call them God sightings. You know, in any organization or gathering I was part of, I would ask about God sightings. Where have you seen God at work? And then I'd ask another question sometimes that would also really feed my soul and give me an experience of God. I would ask people, especially pastors' groups, I'd ask, what's the funniest thing that ever happened to you in ministry? I started that figuring I'd do a book because ministry sometimes is just hilarious. But I've stored up so many stories, but some of them feed my soul about God and His church. You know, one of them is about a pastor told this one that the elder was supposed to prepare communion and his church wasn't there that week. And so a woman volunteered, happened to be the wife of an elder. She volunteered to set up communion. So she came, she got all the juice and the juice. They use separate cups for their communion and got the wafers. They use wafers for communion, got them all set. Communion's all set for Sunday morning. And this pastor is presenting communion and he's pouring it out. He says, you know, the cup represents the blood of Jesus Christ. He's pouring it out. He said, boy, that doesn't look like grape juice or wine. It's too brown. And then he invites people to drink together. And when he takes a drink, he realizes that doesn't taste right. Turns out it's prune juice. You grab the wrong jar out of the refrigerator at church and fill all of these cups with prune juice, and everybody's kind of, you know, puckering up, you know, during communion. And they said there, you know, there was just some titter around as people wondering, what in the world is this stuff? Some don't even drink the whole thing. Well, the woman was embarrassed, and when she found out what was wrong, was embarrassed. But he said the rest of the story is during that next year, she was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And she had to spend a period of time away living with one of her daughters in order to get the treatment that she needed and to get the care that she needed in her daughter's home. And just shortly before she died, she came back to basically say goodbye to her church family. And that morning they had communion, and they had it with prune juice. I hear stories like that, and that tells me the Church of Jesus is alive, and it cares about people. And those experiences that will feed our souls in powerful and wonderful ways. And then they get a fresh view on the mission. And sometimes that involves God identifying who your replacement is going to be, who you're going to take on as a partner in this ministry. Sometimes it's a vision for a new thing. In these courses, I'll be telling you some about that with me as I hit retirement and began to wonder, now what is my ministry? What is my calling? But it took some new ideas to give me energy to move forward. So you are going to face times of despair, times of exhaustion and tiredness. It's not the time to quit. It's the time to withdraw, to let God minister to you through good people around you, through the church that He's given you, but mostly through time with Him. So do that, and you will be an effective leader in the kingdom.